something there called All Blues. I hope you like that one. That was New York Voices. The CD was called What's Inside, and yeah, that dates back away to 1995. Still sounds great though, doesn't it? And they were on GRP. That was their label. New York Voices and All Blues. Before that, you've heard this one before, the Brubeck Brothers Quartet and Dance of the Shadows. The CD is called Classified, it's about a year old, and you'll find that on Koch. The weather for you, while we listen to a little bit of Miles from 58, Stella by Starlight. That's with Coltrane and Cannonball Adderley and Bill Evans. You know, to round out this evening, partly cloudy, lows in the mid-50s. Tuesday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid-70s. Mostly cloudy in the evening, a slight chance of rain after midnight, lows in the mid-50s. It's definitely cooling off. Seems like a little early to be cooling off. And, well, Wednesday shapes like this. Mostly cloudy, a chance of rain, mainly in the afternoon with highs in the mid-60s. The evening, mostly cloudy with a 30% chance of rain, lows around 50. Mostly cloudy on Thursday with a 40% chance of rain, highs in the lower 60s. Wow. Rain likely in the evening, lows in the mid-50s. And if you're heading out on Friday, or if you decide to take the day off, well, this is how it's going to look. It's going to be rain, highs in the lower 70s. And for the evening, if you're going out for a stroll or something along those lines, mostly cloudy with a 50% chance of showers with lows in the mid-50s. That's how it's going to happen this week. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You're tuned to 89.5 FM WPKN Bridgeport and 88.7 FM WPKM Montauk. Scott Harris is up next with Counterpoint. He'll have something interesting to talk about. And here is the White Rose political calendar.
Welcome to this week's edition of the White Rose Political Calendar. The calendar takes its name from the White Rose, a resistance group in Nazi Germany that worked to educate and organize opposition to the horrifying agenda of the Third Reich. In the spirit of the White Rose, WPKN offers its weekly political calendar in order to give voice to the struggles for political, social, environmental, and economic justice. Here are this week's listings. On Tuesday, September 15th and Wednesday, September 16th, Jim Fitz will present a free talk entitled Getting in the Way, Colombian Peace and Justice Stories from Christian Peacemaker Teams. Fitz will describe the CPT's work in Colombia from directly confronting armed groups to organizing soccer games between communities split by war. Come learn about the facts on the ground from someone at the heart of the 40-year-long struggle. Fitz will speak on Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. at Little Portion Friary, 48 Old Post Road in Mount Sinai, New York. Call 631-473-0553 for more information. That's 631-473-0553. And he'll be speaking on Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist of the South Fork Meeting House, 977 Sag Harbor Turnpike in Bridgehampton, New York. Call 631-537-0132 for more information on that one. That's 631-537-0132. On Wednesday, September 16th, the South Country Peace Group is sponsoring a rally for real health reform, including a public option. From 4 to 5 p.m. in Shirley at the intersection of William Floyd Parkway and Montauk Highway. Make and bring a pro-healthcare sign if you can. There will be extra signs for those who need them. For more information, contact Dennis at dmu7@optinline.net. That's D-M as in Mary, U7@optinline.net. Come to a National Equality March bar night on Thursday, September 17th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Partners Cafe, 365 Crown Street in New Haven, to learn more about the National Equality March for LGBT rights. Admission at the bar night is free. The march, scheduled for October 10th and 11th in Washington, D.C., will promote a single demand, equal protection in all matters governed by civil law in all 50 states. Buses will leave from New Haven. Tickets and reservations can be obtained at the bar nights leading up to the march. Join Elm City Cycling on Friday, September 18th for its free monthly bike to work and school day breakfast for all cyclists. Outside New Haven City Hall, 165 Church Street across from the Green. Come anytime between 7:30 and 9:30 a.m. Meet other cyclists, swap information on best cycling routes around Greater New Haven, and learn about efforts to make New Haven a more bike-friendly city. Get involved. Sponsored this month by Cold Spring School and Blue State Cafe. For more information, email bicyclenewhaven@gmail.com. Visit the group's website at elmcitycycling.org or call 203-287-9811. That's 203-287-9811. On Sunday, September 20th, come celebrate the harvest at the 9th Annual Taste Organic Connecticut, sponsored by Connecticut NOFA, to be held Sunday, September 20th, 2009, at Manchester Community College from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Experience the only local and organic festival in Connecticut, offering a farmer's market, fresh prepared food, live music, sustainable vendors, artisans, free workshops, and free kids' activities. Admission is free for those under 12 and over 80. For more information, visit the website of the Connecticut chapter of the Northeast Organic Farming Association at ctnofa.org. The event is sponsored by Stonyfield Farm, Manchester Community College, Whole Foods, Connecticut Farmland Trust, and Patagonia. On Monday, September 21st, Concerned Citizens for the Greater New Haven Dixwell Q House is sponsoring a fundraising event called Hats On for the Q. The group aims to reopen the agency that offered youth and other community programming in the Dixwell neighborhood for 70 years until it was forced to close in 2003. The event will take place from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Savin Rock Conference Center on the shore at Rock Street in West Haven. Attendees are encouraged to, quote, come out and sport your fancy hat for this worthy cause. For more information, call Carol E. Brown at 203-397-3354. That's 203-397-3354. To include your group's upcoming events in the listings of the White Rose political calendar, send information about national, regional, and local events 2 weeks in advance when possible to whiterosewpkn@gmail.com. That's whiterosewpkn@gmail.com. This week's calendar was produced by Melinda Tuhus.
You can hear the White Rose calendar on Mondays around this time, about 8 o'clock, and at various other times during the broadcast week here on WPKM in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. Stay tuned next for Counterpoint, coming right up.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid.
Yeah.
Lester Bangs, birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boom, you symbiotic patriotic slam, but that's right.
Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, here Mondays between 8 and 10 p.m., talking about issues of the day from perspectives that you don't hear all that often in the corporate media. And tonight we're going to be running down healthcare with Ray Stever, of part of a coalition of groups called Healthcare Now. We're going to be taking stock of the current debate in the Capitol and around the country about healthcare reform. A little later on, Norman Solomon will be joining us. He is author of the book War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, and he'll be talking about his recent trip to Afghanistan and what he sees as some major flaws in the Obama administration's policy of escalation in Afghanistan. Later tonight, we'll be hearing from Manny Badillo, a 9/11 family member and activist with the group New York City Coalition for Accountability, which is going to be talking about, he'll be talking about a referendum that will be placed before voters in New York City to conduct an independent investigation of some questions about 9/11 that are still unanswered, and we'll be hearing more about what those questions are and the referendum process, which is certainly unique in the country. Later tonight, Lorelei Kelly, director of the National Security Program for the American Progressive Caucus Policy Foundation, will be here to talk about the stated goal of President Obama to abolish nuclear weapons and an important conference at the United Nations that's happening later this month. So that's all tonight on Counterpoint. And right now, standing by on the phone is Ray Stever. Ray is president of the New Jersey State Industrial Union Council. He's a board member of the national group Healthcare Now and chair of the New Jersey One Plan, One Nation Coalition, which advocates single-payer national health care. Ray, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Scott, thank you very much for having me.
First of all, tell our listener about the groups you're involved with and the role of labor in particular, because you're a labor activist for many years. Tell our listeners a bit about the groups and labor.
Well, let me start with labor. I am, as you said, the president of the Industrial Union Council, which is also known as the IUC. We represent 250,000 union members statewide in New Jersey. We are the last CIO organization, pure CIO organization in the world. We have endorsed in New Jersey H.R. 676, a single-payer movement. It's interesting, we are also part of a national coalition called Labor for Single Payer, .org, and where unions have come together from around the country. What's also interesting is that we're talking now with the AFL meeting in Pittsburgh, and the interesting part to this is that there are well over 400 labor organizations around the country that support single payer. There are 39 state federations. The AFL has 50 of them. And 39 of them have sent in resolutions to the national AFL to be brought up on the floor at the convention to support single payer. And that doesn't count the labor councils from around the country and many independent unions. As a matter of fact, from a labor standpoint, the national has been coming out supporting the public option from Obama, but the National Health Committee inside the AFL has been divided because there was a single-payer caucus that was also created, headed up by the Greg Juneman, the president of IFPTE, and Roseanne DeMuro from the California Nurses Association, and the steelworkers are on board, and there are other unions that have endorsed this. So there is a major move, hopefully, that the National AFL Convention this week will endorse single payer. An interesting aspect to the labor's perspective is that when we negotiate contracts, the two issues that are always left on the table are benefits and wages. And the benefits will always affect the wages because corporations, and rightfully so, have been dealing with the out-of-control costs from insurance companies. And they've been, the increases have been yearly, it's been over 400% over the last 10 years. So when a company has to deal with the union members, it affects their wages because they say we can't give you a raise because of the health care benefits that are going up. And then when it does affect the wages, it affects them to where they may not get a raise, or they ask the workers that may have gotten a raise in the contract that they're going to have to pick up some of the cost on the health care. So around all the other industrialized nations around the world that have a single-payer system, this is not an issue. The unions don't have to negotiate health care benefits because it's already embedded in their social fabric. So, you know, they basically do the wage aspect. So that affects, that will affect every American in the labor movement here regarding how we go forward from a labor's perspective with single payer. Healthcare Now is a national organization of activists and unions and coalition members and organizations from around the country that believe in the single-payer movement. We have everybody from the president of Leo Girard from the steelworkers is a board member. We have support from the National Organization for Women, the Presbyterian Church, Progressive Democrats of America, and many other groups. And from New Jersey's perspective, the One Plan, One Nation coalition that I created, we felt that we needed to get something a little bit more local. There were many groups all over the country, but I wanted to create something to bring, at least in Jersey, to bring the these many different groups around the state together. And we have in our organization, the National Organization for Women from New Jersey to president. We have the People's Organization for Progress, Progressive Democrats, PNHP, Physicians for a National Health Plan, which also sit on the board of the of Healthcare Now on the national level, also sit on the state level here. Healthcare Now itself sits at the state level. And we're just going out educating. And that's a big word that we're using at the moment in the sense that people are not being made aware from the general media, not with folks as helpful as yourself, but from the general media about what single payer is and how it can affect them and how make their life that much better and cost efficient. They're only talking the public option in the general terms, and they're not discussing that the single payer is the best way to go. So all these groups are going out, whether it's dealing with rank and file union members or whether we're dealing with the general public. We're going out of our way to sit down with people in their living rooms, to meet at churches, to meet at clubs, to meet at union halls, and explain to them the benefits of single-payer health care and the bill that is H.R. 676, which a lot of folks don't realize that we don't need 3,200. John Conyers has a bill, H.R. 676, which is called the United States National Health Insurance Act, and will deliver single-payer health care through the Medicare system.
Well, Ray, that's a good rundown of all the very many groups that are involved in this effort and have not really come up on the radar screen of the major media like we've been talking about. But I wanted to get your take on President Obama's speech last Wednesday. Of course, that was necessary after a summer of deliberate misinformation coming from opponents of health care reform, many funded by large corporations, including the health insurance industry itself. But what do you think President Obama gained with his speech last Wednesday? What did you like about it? What didn't you like about it? Where do you think that puts the country now in terms of having what many believe was really the final weeks of the debate on where health care reform is going to go?
That's a very broad question. I supported President Obama, but I am disappointed of his commitment to a health care system that would be a lot broader and better for the American people. His speech the other night speaks eloquently, was well done. He gave some details as to what 3200 would be about. But everything that he mentioned, especially when he said the law, it would be against the law for insurance companies to infringe upon people that they would have pre-existing conditions. They can't impose that upon people. That is automatic on the single payer. You don't need to write a law for that. That would be included under H.R. 676. That's an automatic deal. Once you've eliminated the insurance companies, people would be covered from cradle to grave. So there are no restrictions placed upon them by the insurance companies as to pre-existing conditions or experimental drugs or just the ability for them to deny an individual coverage because they decided it shouldn't happen. The general tone was well taken. Many of our Democratic friends are looking for the support for a public option. But those of us in the single-payer movement know that there is more out there, that there is better out there. H.R. 676 basically is simple, it's economic, it's humane. The bill itself is 28 pages. The bill, H.R. 3200, which is part of the public option angle, is 1,000 pages with a whole lot of caveats and with a whole lot of provisos and possibly quid pro quos. So something that detailed and intricate is nowhere near the simple 28-page H.R. 676 bill.
We're speaking with Ray Stever, president of the New Jersey State Industrial Union Council and board member of the national group Healthcare Now. Ray, what are your concerns about where this debate goes from here, given that there's a lot of opposition by Republicans, of course, and conservative Democrats in the Senate to even including a watered-down version of a public option, which many people are concerned wouldn't even cover everybody in the country who currently does not have health insurance? Where do you think things are headed? And do you think there's room for a compromise here from where you're sitting, from labor's interests here in reforming health care? Do you think a compromise is something that could be hammered out here that would benefit the majority of American people who currently don't have health insurance or certainly stand to lose it, you know, if they lose their job or otherwise have a catastrophic illness in the family?
Well, the interesting part with this is that the going from labor's perspective, the National AFL has emphatically said that a public option has to be part of the plan. But there are pieces of this that are coming out through the Senate that, you know, they expect the American people to pay for it. That is wrong. We're dealing with an industry that makes $2 trillion a year profit. And then they're going to turn over 47 million Americans that have no health care to the insurance companies. That's like bailing them out again. And the insurance companies are not an industry that needs any bailing out. So by turning over all that money, all you're going to do is enhance their profit margins and make the CEOs bigger fat cats than where they stand right now. It currently, the for-profit insurance companies take 30 cents on the dollar. Now remember, insurance companies are corporations, and they have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders first. Not to their clients, which are the American people. And they're basically a system of middlemen. They take your money, and then they'll tell you exactly what doctor you can see or what hospital you can go to, and placing other limitations upon your coverage. The single-payer system, which will benefit all Americans, will turn around and allow the people to choose their own doctor. The care isn't decided by a clerk sitting at the insurance company's office making a decision by denying you care, which means they're not going to pay that money, which then will allow their profit margin to go up. This is decisions that are made between the patient and the doctor, whatever it may be, whether it's medication, procedure, whatever. Then the insurance will be paid by the government, which is the Medicare system, and it will be, the bill would be paid to the doctor for his coverage of this patient and so forth. So when labor stands up and says that the public option needs to be in place, that's only part of the thing. The American people shouldn't be paying the burden to the insurance companies, especially under the Senate bill. Well, now they're talking a mandate. And the mandate is even more insulting because that's a model after the Massachusetts plan. And what many folks have been told that the Massachusetts plan is good, it is not. If a person in Massachusetts cannot afford health care, then the government penalizes them. And they get fined almost $1,000 for not having health insurance. Do we need to worry about that and for on a national level? We shouldn't have to. The word affordability is a word that the insurance companies are saying, well, we're going to make the insurance more affordable. Tell that to a person who has just lost their job or have just had been in layoff or have been terminated. They're right now struggling whether to make ends meet between their rent and their food. They shouldn't have to worry about health coverage. And health coverage, which has been going through the roof as far as the main situation, why there's bankruptcies, medical debt is 62%. And two-thirds of those that have had bankruptcies because of medical reasons have been filed by people who have health insurance. So it's carrying over to where every single American needs to get in touch with their congressman and let them know that the way they're going, whether it's with the Senate, and the Senate really is basically eliminating the public option. So are we really having health insurance reform? I don't think so. What people need to understand is the functions of an insurance company is one other piece, and that piece is health care. When we talk, I consider health care to be our well-being, our functioning as a human being to live, breathe, and to function. There are other aspects of our life that, if you notice, isn't being mentioned. There is dental. There is eyeglass. There is hearing. There is mental health care and others that have not been discussed. But from an insurance standpoint, those issues that I just raised, dental, eyeglass, and hearing, are separate plans, which means there are separate costs, which means beyond health care, you're going to need other things as an individual. You're going to have to pay extra for them. And insurance companies level themselves in plans, whether it's Plan A down to Plan Z. But the better the Plan A, which is the Cadillac plan, is extremely expensive. Plan Z may be the less plan. So if you can afford that, but that means you're going to have more co-pays, more deductibles, more premiums, and possibly more out-of-cost out of your pocket because many medical procedures will not be covered under the lesser plans. And that's the one thing that 676 eliminates. The bill will eliminate all co-pays, all premiums, and all deductibles, and any further out-of-pocket expenses. They don't tell you this with the public option. They haven't even gone down that road, but the American people need to know that all of this is a benefit to them, and the cost-saving measure is astronomical.
Hey, Steve, we got Republican Senator Olympia Snowe from Maine, who talks about not having a public option in a Senate bill, but putting in something called a trigger. Now, it gets into a lot of complexities here, but the bottom line is, as we're running out of time here quickly, and I've been asking a lot of people who are single-payer proponents, such as yourself, who are disappointed with the turn of events here and how this whole debate was handled. Do you think it's better to vote for a flawed health care reform bill now or to have no legislation at all and start from scratch later on? What's your view?
My view first is H.R. 676, which, by the way, Well, there is an amendment, and I hope your listeners understand this. Congressman Wiener will be introducing an amendment on the floor of Congress for H.R. 676. And the amendment is to support, to replace the bill known as 3200, which is the public option, which basically stinks. We need our listeners to reach out to their congressmen to tell them to support the Wiener Amendment. If we are stuck with this H.R. 3200, there is another amendment in that bill that was placed in there by Dennis Kucinich, which the language makes it accessible that single payer will be brought up through the states. So we need our folks to contact their congressmen also and let and tell them that they want them to support the Kucinich Amendment. But in the whole broader picture of everything, the American people need to understand that the politicians that I've met with, that many of them spoken to, who have said this single payer, and many of them said they support it, but it isn't politically feasible, they need to understand that only educated public can make it feasible. Because they said it wasn't politically feasible when the women had the ability to have the right to vote. They said it wasn't politically feasible to have Social Security. They said it wasn't politically feasible to have the Civil Rights Movement. They said it wasn't politically feasible to have Medicare in 1965, which means that Medicare was made in America. It's an American health plan. That's the foundation for single payer. The people need to rise up. They need to call their congressmen and let them know that they want them to support H.R. 676. They want them to support the Wiener Amendment. And they want them to at least support, if we have to get stuck with 3200, no matter what Olympia Snow says, we got to make sure that we have single payer, whether it's at the federal level or at least by the Kucinich Amendment, to be able to have it put together on the state level. You know, the state level, Pennsylvania is close to passing a state piece on single payer. California passed it twice. The Republican governor, Schwarzenegger, vetoed it twice. There is a strong movement out there for this. It's just that we need to talk to our friends, our neighbors, to go to the websites, healthcare-now.org. You can find out everything that you need to know about single payer. You can go to our website, NJONEPLAN. You can find out from Jersey. Just to give you another heads up, from a Jersey perspective, this is why we don't need these other co-ops and things that are being done. The state of New Jersey, if we had single payer, we could save the state $2.5 billion. Now, that's something Governor Corzine needs to be aware of, and that's something that the citizens, at least from New Jersey that are listening, need to know, that just by eliminating the health care from state workers, union and non, and then replacing it with single payer, the state would save $1.7 billion on that, and if you get rid of the charity care to the hospitals, we would save almost another billion there. So there is money to be had in this economy where municipalities and counties and states need the help. What better way to get the best health care in the world than through a system that was already created by the American people in 1965. It's called Medicare.
Medicare for All, as the nickname
Medicare
goes
for All, exactly.
Which is a That's translation of what single payer really is.
This is for National Health Plan, lay it out that way. Single payer, H.R. 676, Medicare for All.
All right, we're out of time, Ray. Thanks so much for being here with us tonight. The website of the group that you're on the board of, Healthcare Now. The website is healthcare-now.org, and a lot of information there. And the state-by-state maybe is the way that is going to happen here eventually. That's the way it happened in Canada, with the first province going to a single payer, and the rest of the country and Canada followed. you know, some years later. But
and that's why Tommy Douglas is considered the greatest Canadian of all times.
Right. That's right. And most Americans don't know who that is, but every Canadian does, that's for sure.
That's for sure. And they don't want to give up their health care.
No, despite all the misinformation. Ray, it's been great to have you here tonight. Good luck to all of us on this health care reform or deform, or however you want to view it. But I appreciate all that you're doing out there, and I know many of our listeners do too.
Scott, thank you very much for having us.
Take care, Ray. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Ray Stever, president of the New Jersey State Industrial Union Council, single-payer advocate, and board member of the national group HealthcareNow.org. Stay tuned. We've got another interview coming up. This one on Afghanistan with columnist and author Norman Solomon, who just got back from a visit to Kabul, Afghanistan. We'll hear some firsthand accounts of the way that war is going. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Commercial listener-supported radio, WPKN, 89.5 FM in Bridgeport and 88.7 FM in Montauk.
And this is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris here, Mondays between 8 and 10 p.m. We're glad you're with us tonight. And following our discussion on health care reform, or what's left of it, we are now joined on the phone by Norman Solomon. He's a columnist and author. He's the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. And we're going to be talking about the issue of Afghanistan and the ongoing war there. I should just mention that Norman Solomon is author of a dozen books, including Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State, and War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, which also was the basis for our documentary film released in 2007. Norman Solomon visited Afghanistan in late August and wrote several very important articles about the status of things on the ground there. Norman, thanks for being here with us tonight.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
I'd like to start with one very moving piece that you had written while you were in Kabul, and that was your encounter with a 7-year-old girl who had lost her arm in a U.S. bombing raid on her village. And it seemed to move you quite a bit in this article and represent a lot of what's wrong with the U.S. war effort in Afghanistan. What insights into this war did you gain from meeting this little girl?
Well, after all the policy wonkery is done and all the analysis is completed and the various spinning and accusations, of course, what's important is really what happens for people. And we've heard a lot in the last few months about, with an echo from the Vietnam War, trying from the U.S. side to, quote, win the hearts and minds, and a lot of emphasis on trying to make alliances and friends with Afghan people from the United States. But I happened, without any sort of preparation by anybody, to meet this little girl who was living and is living still, as far as I know, 2 weeks later in the Helmand Refugee Camp District 5 facility in Kabul. And it's a kind of a stretch to call it a facility, I suppose, because it basically was a bunch of ditches and torn canvas and mud structures and an occasional water pump. And so with a couple of companions, I dropped in on this refugee camp unannounced and met her father and heard her describe waking up just before dawn, she said about 5 a.m., to the commotion, to the huge cataclysmic sound and shaking of bombs falling on her neighborhood. And, Scott, as you mentioned, she lost her arm in the attack. She lost several relatives who were killed. And I think what, beyond the human suffering involved, what really stunned me was that a year later, she and her father were living in this, at best, squalid refugee camp, and the same U.S. government that had basically taken an arm from this 7-year-old girl was doing nothing for her. And it's not as though she was some just totally extraordinary example. We happened across her pretty much by chance. There were 700 families in this refugee camp. Many of them had fled the bombing. So this, I think, is a tragedy in human terms and also a symbol and a metaphor for the gap between all the rhetoric about trying to help the people of Afghanistan and what the priorities of this war really are.
Maybe you could explore that with us for a moment, Norman.
Sure.
I just want to preface it by saying we hear a lot of talk from President Obama where he admits the obvious that the war in Afghanistan will not be won with military means alone. So he talks about seeking a diplomatic solution and also working to alleviate the incredible poverty that that the Afghan people have suffered, especially exacerbated in large part by 30 years of war, which the U.S. has played a very large role in.
It's one thing, you know, to see the numbers about how much money the U.S. is spending. I mean, this is our tax dollars. And even last year, $100 million a day from the U.S. Treasury, which is to say taxpayer money, was going to the war in Afghanistan. That number is rising now. It's approaching $200 million a day. And an Oxfam study last year found that 7% of the money going into Afghanistan was for humanitarian purposes, compared to the rest of it, so 93%+ for military purposes from the U.S. And the supplemental bill that went through the Congress, proposed and then signed by President Obama a few months ago for war in Iraq and Afghanistan, provided for U.S. money being spent in and on Afghanistan to be 90% military and 10% non-military. And so while on the face of it, that is just really a contradiction in relation to the claims that the administration is making about its emphasis on the war, when we were on the ground in Kabul a couple of weeks ago, we could see it in human terms. And, you know, at first glance, it's like, wow, this is crazy. Why can't this wealthy U.S. government take care of these people? And then it sunk in that this war is not about helping people. This war is about winning militarily. And whatever the rhetoric may be, when push comes to shove, when the war is the top priority, that's where the money goes.
Now, what about this election, Norman? What are your impressions of this recent Afghan election, which has certainly been tainted by thousands of incidents or charges of incidents of fraud and ballot stuffing and the like? Some very blatant episodes have been described in the press. What does it say about the United States' relationship with the incumbent president, Hamid Karzai?
Well, going into the election, it was clear that Hamid Karzai, as president of Afghanistan, is inept and corrupt. But what now is clear through the election day process on August 20th and the vote counting, or the not vote counting, depending on how you look at it, afterwards, and all the ballot stuffing and all the rest of it, is that the Karzai government is illegitimate as well. And that was widely understood by a wide range of people in Afghanistan. I think one of the few I met who didn't seem to feel that way was Hekmat Karzai, who is a cousin of the president of Afghanistan. And that, of course, was a different sort of message coming from him. The U.S. government is really in a bind because, you know, if you look at a book like Descent into Chaos by Ahmed Rashid, the great Pakistani journalist who's covered Afghanistan for three decades, you see the clear documentation that in 2002, the CIA basically embraced and crowned, if I can use that term, Karzai as president of Afghanistan. So he has been the U.S. government's boy over there to run the government, but you might say that good help is hard to find. And so he has not been very satisfying to the Washington elites and the White House, especially in recent months. And it's clear that this year the U.S. government began to look around for somebody else, hoping that Karzai would lose. But he's not losing, partly because he's counting the votes, and now there's the big push-pull about exactly how those votes will be counted. I think it's clear from the special envoy, Richard Holbrooke, and others who were in high positions in Washington, that they, while being somewhat joined at the hip with Karzai, they would just as soon throw him under the bus. It's just, what do you replace him with? And so I think that helps to explain, A, why there has been so much coverage of the ballot stuffing and rigging and vote tampering and all that in the U.S. press covering the election. And also it helps to explain why there's been a lot of fairly good coverage of Abdullah Abdullah, who is the main rival, the only person with a chance of making it into the runoff. What isn't talked about is that Abdullah is himself a war criminal, a major warlord, somebody who was as a disciple of Massoud, the much-loved and by others much much hated Tajik warlord who got some CIA money and from Pakistan and so forth earlier on in the 80s and 90s. Abdullah himself was directly involved in the horrible bombing and rocketry war that killed 65,000 people in Kabul between 1992 and 1996, which is to say after the Soviets had left, after Kabul had fallen to Najibullah, the Soviet sort of semi-puppet, had fallen from power, and then there was that 4 years of struggle before the Taliban took over Kabul in 1996. So, you know, here we have, to kind of sum it up, you got Karzai, who has embraced people like General Dostum, the Uzbek warlord, himself with tremendous blood on his hands. And the only other person with a chance to be elected now or in the runoff is a guy who's a warlord, Abdullah, with tremendous blood on his hands. And as Malala Joya, a great feminist who was in hiding when I met her because she's survived so many assassination attempts, she can no longer serve in the parliament to which she was elected in Afghanistan. She said, you know, you can shave a warlord and put a suit on him and give him a haircut. He's still a warlord. And so her feeling, as with many, is that it's now a choice between basically two sides with many, many gallons of blood on their hands.
So it's what is the perception you have of the people in Afghanistan and Kabul that you met? What do they want most? You talk briefly. In one article you wrote, you described visiting a women's project that taught women business skills, basic business skills, and mutual support was really the main ingredient there for moving into businesses. But they told you something that I think struck you pretty powerfully, that you know, beyond Karzai and Abdullah and the warlords and the horrendous violence that has been wrought upon Afghanistan for so many decades, what did the women there tell you they wanted?
Well, it's something that can be summed up in one word, and that's peace. You know, peace is a prerequisite for a decent life. It makes all other dreams possible. And for us here in this country, well, it may seem sort of vague or wispy, but it has the meaning of life itself in Afghanistan. As you mentioned, after three decades of war, the tremendous poverty in the country cannot be alleviated without peace. And I spoke to one guy who is now in his 40s, who's lived in Kabul his whole life, and I asked, you know, what was the worst time in the city? And without hesitation, he said it was during what they call the Civil War, as I mentioned, 1992 to 1996. He didn't mention the Russians occupying. He didn't mention the years of Taliban rule. As awful as those time periods were, it was a time when there was the absolute total 180-degree opposite of peace in the city where he has lived his whole life, the capital city of Kabul. And, you know, to see buildings in flames every night and then to endure that for years on end, it's a tremendous need now to have peace. And that's one of the reasons why, after so much violence for so many years, the notion of the U.S. government trying to supposedly improve the situation by escalating the violence and killing in the country, that makes no sense to me.
Well, Norman, you know, a lot of this comes down to the United States' interests in Afghanistan, whether it's eradicating a safe sanctuary for the Al-Qaeda terrorists that, you know, wrought such havoc and death on this country 8 years ago on 9/11. And then, of course, there's the other issue of, you know, what's good for the Afghans.
Yeah.
What to Afghans that you spoke with on your trip there, what is it that they, in particular, would like to see right now? And I would maybe frame it a little bit differently here by asking you, what's their attitude towards the Taliban? Did you find a mixed, you know, mixed bag of attitudes and feelings towards the Taliban, the former Taliban government, and the current guerrilla fighters?
Well, to back up, there is no al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. You can't find an expert who says al-Qaeda has any sort of presence in Afghanistan. They're elsewhere, in Pakistan and other countries. I would say overall from, and I did talk to many Afghans in many walks of life, and I think that the Taliban is reviled and very much disliked and feared. And many people point out, and I think it's quite true, the Taliban ideology is foreign to Afghan traditional culture, which is Sufi influence, which has not been doctrinaire, and it was the importation along with the Stinger missiles and the weapons and the billions of dollars through the ISI, Pakistani Intelligence Service pipeline, money supplied by the Saudis and by the U.S. government through the CIA. Imported along with that was this horrible ideology, this Wahhabi, narrow, misogynist, violent, sectarian, and vicious ideology, much of which the Taliban has absorbed, although not in a monochromatic way. As far as I can tell from conversations we had, we did some polling, informal polling in a classroom with about 40 students who speak, most of them were speaking English and studying psychology and sociology at Kabul University, and this does track with the polls that I've seen. Most Afghans do not want more U.S. troops in their country. Most Afghans do not want the U.S. to continue to bomb from the air and kill civilians. Most Afghans do not want the U.S. military to disappear from their country overnight. There's a lot of talk about training Afghan security and army forces and then the U.S. gradually disappearing. How realistic that is another question, given that the Taliban is on ascendancy, winning more and more, if that's the right term, at least being able to visit upon various parts of the country a lot of attacks that kill. And I think ultimately the solution is not only negotiation with the Taliban, but has to be in tandem with change in U.S. attitude towards Pakistan, which after all has supported the Taliban for a very long time, dealing with Pakistan's fears about India, dealing with poverty, as you mentioned, Scott, one of the most poor countries in the world. I'll just give one statistic that's mind-blowing. Out of every 1,000 live births, according to the CIA fact book, there are 154 infant deaths before the age of one. That is an infant mortality rate of 15%. It's a marker and indicator of reflection of just the tremendous suffering and poverty. And here the U.S. is spending 90% of its expenditures in Afghanistan on military purposes. It's just a way to continue to wreck the country. And, you know, the news media, I would just sort of close my comments on this question in this way. A lot of the U.S. news media keep asking, can the United States win in Afghanistan? I think that's the wrong question. The correct question to ask, if we're going to raise those sorts of questions, is, should the United States continue to be destroying Afghanistan in order to supposedly save it?
Norman Solomon is our guest, a columnist on media and politics, executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and author of many books, including the book titled War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. A documentary film was based on this book and released in 2007. Norman, there is some talk that the United States should negotiate with the Taliban to end this war. The Taliban, of course, are notorious for repressing women in the country and brutal intolerance towards those who do not share their belief in their brand of fundamentalist Islam. Do you think the United States should sit down with Mullah Omar or other representatives of the Taliban?
Well, yes, as well as with Pakistani and Saudi and other leaders throughout the region. The reality is that the Taliban is, as you mentioned, it's also a movement that is Pashtun and nationalistic in nature and has somewhat circumscribed goals and really is distinct in terms of its priorities and methodology from al-Qaeda. But it has to be a sort of a regional context, really, to make any sense. I should mention that you can't bomb a country into respecting women. And a recent stat I heard from a UN worker in Afghanistan is that a well-documented survey shows 89% of Afghan women being subjected to very serious domestic violence at home. And to ratchet up overall violence through warfare in the country, there's no way that makes things better. It only makes things worse.
Well, Norman, just finally here, if you had the ear of President Obama after your recent trip to Afghanistan, what's the most important thing that you could convey to him that you think would convince him to change his course in escalating the war in Afghanistan?
I would say that it's essential, if the sources of violence and misery in Afghanistan are going to be changed and reversed, to flip over the priorities of U.S. spending. I would advocate for, instead of 90% military and 10% non-military, exactly the opposite. If 90% of the U.S. spending in Afghanistan were for the purposes of fighting, alleviating, and getting people out of poverty, then we have a real chance both to improve the quality of life in that country and to defeat the Taliban. We forget that the Taliban came into power as an alternative to the corruption of the warlords, many of whom the United States was supporting. So we need to lead morally as well as every other which way. And I would sort of sum it up that in his inaugural address, President Obama said that leaders elsewhere in the world will be judged not by what they destroy, but by what they create. And I think the same standard needs to be applied to President Obama.
Well said, Norman. Please leave our listeners with your own website or other sites that you think would be, provide some good context and information about the war in Afghanistan we may not be getting from other sources.
Sure. Well, the delegation to Afghanistan that I was part of was sponsored by the Institute for Public Accuracy, where I'm executive director, and we're on the web at accuracy.org, and we'd welcome people's support and going to our site at accuracy.org for information. And my articles from the trip and elsewhere are posted on my website, normansolomon.com.
Okay, so that's accuracy.org for the Institute for Public Accuracy, and your own site, normansolomon.com. As always, it's been great to talk with you about some of these complex issues, and I'm glad you could bring back your perspective that you have from Afghanistan, seeing some of this up close and personal, which, of course, most of us won't get a chance to do. And thanks for all your reporting on this, Norman.
Hey, thank you, Scott.
Take care. Bye-bye. That was Norman Solomon, columnist on media and politics, executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and again, author of the excellent book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, a documentary film based on that as well. It's 1 minute past 9 p.m. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. The show is Counterpoint. We're going to be back with our second hour of the program, and we're going to be talking about 9/11 and a very interesting referendum project that seems to have won the day in New York City. That will be coming right up. We'll be speaking with Manny Badillo of the group called New York City Coalition for Accountability Now. So stay tuned for that. And lastly, tonight, our final segment, we'll have Lorelei Kelly, who's going to be talking to us about some important doings at the United Nations regarding the effort to not only eliminate, but to, I guess, initially reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons from the face of the earth. So some interesting things happening there. Do stay tuned. And just a program note, I won't be here next Monday evening, but able sitting in for me here on Counterpoint next Monday between 8 and 10 will be Eric Ford. So stay tuned for that next week, and I'll be back the last Monday in September. But anyway, here's some music from John Fogerty about Vietnam.
Did you hear him talking about it on the radio? Did you try to read the writing on the wall? Did that voice all before. It's like deja vu all over again. Day by day, I hear the voices rising, starting with a whisper like it did before. Day by day, we count the dead and dying, ship the bodies home, while the networks all keep stopping. Did you hear them talking about it on the radio? Could your
This is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris here, Mondays between 8 and 10 p.m. Thanks for tuning in tonight. We just passed the 8th year since the September 11th terrorist attacks, which killed more than 2,800 Americans in New York City at the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a deliberate crashed airliner in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And there are a lot of people in this country that still have important questions to ask about what happened on 9/11. Many people and many in this audience not very satisfied with the 9/11 commission, which the Bush administration grudgingly appointed and Congress helped to institute. But the answers weren't all that satisfying, and there seemed to be, to put it lightly, a lot swept under the rug. With us tonight to discuss an interesting project, an important project that's has had some major successes in New York City, is Manny Badillo. And Manny Badillo is a 9/11 family member and an active member of the group We Are Change, New York City Coalition for Accountability Now, otherwise known by its acronym NYCCAN. And Manny, thanks so much for spending some time with us tonight.
Well, Scott, thank you very much for allowing this discussion to take place. It's very important that information gets out to the public about some great strides we, the people, are taking in order to get to the truth of what happened when my uncle was murdered just over 8 years ago, along with 3,000 others.
Tell us about your uncle.
My uncle, he was the rock. He was the mentor of our family. He was the light. The man was just incredible and incredibly successful, incredibly cordial. I mean, I still feel as if I feel as if he should be here today. And a lot of that is based on the fact that, you know, what I've learned just in the past few years. I say that I didn't just lose one family member when I lost my uncle. I lost three. My grandparents, unfortunately, got very sick right after my uncle's murder, and they passed as well. So the family has suffered, and not only has my family and 3,000 other families suffered, tens of thousands of first responders have suffered. The heroes who went in to rescue and recover my uncle's body, they're dying based on the lies the government told them. Over 800 have died already. That should be front page news. Why I've only heard one of their stories. And so many survivors are suffering today. So NYC Can, the Coalition for Accountability Now, really unifies those groups and allows for them and all of us to pursue the truth and get to the justice and get to the accountability due all of us.
You and your organization collected tens of thousands of signatures to get an important ballot measure before New York City voters this November. Tell our listeners about that project.
Well, NYC Can, we are, this is about as grassroots as it gets. We are an organization that allows for we the people to democratically act by signing a petition. We have one-on-one with people here in New York City. We ask them if they're New York City voters. They sign a petition that allows for a referendum to be put on this November's ballot, giving New York City voters the opportunity to say yes to a new and proper, impartial, non-political, subpoena-powered, and privately funded investigation into the events which took place on 9/11. In the first public inquiry, only 30% of the Family Steering Committee's questions were answered. That is not justice. Here in New York, we look to have 100% of the questions answered concerning the events of 9/11, and that in itself will bring, well, it's going to save a lot of lives, but it'll bring the justice due. It'll bring the accountability, and what we need is the truth of what really happened, because the evidence in the public forum is so very different from what the U.S. government has been telling us for so many years.
Yeah, I want to get to those important questions and some of the lines of investigation that you would like to see this commission, if approved by voters, pursue. But tell us, there was a lot of difficulty in getting this on the ballot. I mean, you guys have been struggling for a while. You got 30,000 signatures. Is it definite that this question will appear on the ballot in November? Has that been settled?
It is not definite yet. There are 3 weeks worth of litigation that is taking place right now. There has to be a final decision by the courts here in New York as to the legality of the petition. And what we're looking for is to have this petition put on the November ballot, you know, basically saying that this is the intent of We the People. We handed in 52,000 signatures about 2.5 months ago. The city said only 26,000 were valid. We only needed 30,000 to continue the process. Well, 50 volunteers, 1,000-plus man hours, we went in, we validated and verified over 7,000 signatures. We said, okay, here's the bill of particulars that the court asked for. And even before the court-appointed referee began to look at our work, New York City conceded and said, you have enough votes. We then handed in another 28,000 signatures 10 days ago to override any decision by the city council to have this automatically put on the ballot. So right now, it's only the legality of the petition, which will be argued in the courts for the next up until September 30th. After that, we'll know if it's going to be on the November ballot.
Now, when you say the legality of the question, is that sort of can voters at the polls approve and institute an investigative body such as this commission that you want to set up? Is that the main question, if that's legal?
That's excellent. That's a great question. Yes, that's one of the issues that the city has in fighting the intent of the voter is whether or not this petition, you know, can, you know, have a referendum assembled here in New York that puts together commissioners and has subpoena power, and whether or not even New York City has jurisdiction over the events instead of the state or federal government. So those are a few of the issues that will be argued in court over the next 3 weeks.
Okay, so there's litigation to go, and then, of course, once that's approved, and hopefully it will be, voters should have their say on this, either yay or nay. They should have an opportunity to say they want a commission or not, given that certainly New York City was the epicenter of the greatest part of this tragic day 8 years ago on 9/11. But, Manny, tell our listeners about the mechanics of this. If voters approve this referendum in November, what would a commission look like? Who would be appointed to it? And what would be their specific mission?
Essentially, the specific mission of the commission would be to answer all relevant questions relating to the event. And that's answering 100% of the questions, as opposed to what the original public inquiry did by answering only 30. The commission will be composed of a range of different individuals, non-political, non-governmental affiliated. Right now we have a number of commissioners as stated on the petition. That's another issue New York City is contesting. Regardless, we would like to have the commission comprised mostly of family members, first responders, and survivors, the ones most intimately affected and the ones that would pursue the truth and pursue the justice the right way, as opposed to having to deal with political considerations. So the mission of the commission would be to essentially write the proper history of what happened during 9/11, because that first inquiry, I'm sorry, all the polls show it, the majority of family members know it, the majority of first responders know it. We didn't get the whole story, as per 60% of the commissioners themselves from 5 years ago. We need to get to the truth, and when we get there, that's when we'll be better able to act on so many other important issues in our future.
Manny, who would appoint these commissioners? And I guess, you know, that's a logistical or mechanical question, really, but it tends to be important, and given your priority to have an impartial and non-political and independent commission, so that I guess that is a central question. And beyond that, too, I wanted to ask you, what would be the power of this commission to subpoena individuals from government or from the military or from whoever has a relevant story to tell about what happened that day?
Well, the commissioners would be appointed by an initial set of commissioners. Right now we have 7 on the petition. They would then elect the next 8. Even if the city fights this, there will always be a deciding membership that will decide the majority of the commission. That deciding membership needs to be impartial and non-political and put together by family members and survivors and first responders. That's one of the ways that we look to have this commission, being a commission that can get to the truth without having to consider all these other aspects, especially political aspects. What we're also looking for is we're looking to have subpoena power to protect the witnesses and to ensure that people that do speak out about the facts of the day are protected. In the original investigation, there was subpoena power, but it was used sparingly. There are many whistleblowers that have spoken out about how the government knew at the very least and at the very most something even more devious. Colleen Rowley, Sybil Edmonds are just two of so many whistleblowers that have spoken out. None of their testimony has managed to get to the public forum, though there has been an investigation that's been taking place throughout the world. And just by looking at the evidence, the scientific, the physical, empirical, corroborated evidence that's in the public forum, one will come to a very different conclusion than what the U.S. government has been telling us.
We're speaking tonight on Counterpoint with Manny Badillo, and Manny is a 9/11 family member. His uncle was killed in the 9/11 attacks, and he's an activist with a group, New York City Coalition for Accountability Now, NYC CAN, which is hoping to place a referendum on the ballot this November before New York City voters to establish a commission, an independent commission, to conduct an investigation into the unanswered questions about 9/11. Manny, tell our listeners some of the central questions that you want this commission to investigate, that the questions that have been haunting you for all these many years.
Well, I would implore people to go to the 9/11 Family Steering Committee website. Just type that into any search engine. You'll see a list of questions. 400 were submitted by the Family Steering Committee, which was set up by Act of Congress alongside the 9/11 Commission. And also you can go to nyccan.org to take a look at the petition and also some of the questions that the family members had submitted. And you know, essentially 400 were submitted, only 150 were partially answered or fully answered. That leaves a wealth of other questions to be asked and answered. And I have a few myself. Why was that crime scene cleaned up so quickly? There is still no memorial at Ground Zero. I was with other family members on Friday in a very fitting day. The weather was intense. It was cloudy. It was rainy. It was windy. That's how every September 11th I feel should be, because it's a very solemn day. And it's not a day where you want to have blue skies and sunshine, because that's how September 11th, 2001 was. Why was that crime scene cleaned up so quickly? How did those buildings implode on themselves? Fire does not turn 110-story steel-reinforced, commercial-grade steel-reinforced buildings to dust and molten metal. I'm sorry, that doesn't happen. It's against the laws of physics. Governments lie, people lie, the laws of physics do not. I want to know why NORAD lied to the commission, why NORAD couldn't scramble jets within 5 to 10 minutes, which is the normal operating procedure, why it took over 80 minutes for a jet to come anywhere near one of the hijacked aircraft. I want to know what happened at the Pentagon. I want to know why the mayor of Shanksville and the coroner in Shanksville said there are no bodies here. This doesn't even look like an aircraft crash. I want to know so many more questions, but essentially I want to know, why were the American people deceived, and why were the family members lied to and the first responders lied to, starting in the days after 9/11? Why are the ones who, the heroes of that day, who are sick and dying today, not getting the proper health care that they need? Why are they dying of all these exotic lung ailments and cancers? What is in their lungs besides asbestos that is causing them to be so ill? What about the peer-reviewed and refereed scientific study that came out 5 months ago by Stephen Jones and Kevin Ryan and seven other scientists from here in Europe? Why has that study, which proves that there were highly engineered military-grade explosives found in the debris of the World Trade Center, why has that not been front page news, and how does that relate directly to those buildings coming down? And what happened to the Salomon Brothers building, Building 7. Small fires, 47-story tall building, would have been the tallest in 33 states, collapsed symmetrically into its own footprint, the path of most resistance at free fall speed at 5:30 in the afternoon on 9/11. And why do only 5% of Americans even know that occurred?
Those are some important questions. And, you know, I think for myself and anybody listening who got, you know, certainly very different points of view on what happened that day and how it occurred and, you know, the various theories put forward and their credibility, I think it goes without saying that there were important questions not answered by the federal government commission, and that a local initiative such as yours, you know, that's sponsored by family members of the victims of 9/11, is important to go forward, because we all need to get more answers here than we got from the government commission. And you, above all else, you and the other 9/11 family members deserve those answers. I think we as the people of this country deserve those answers. So whatever our attitudes on the various theories, I hope and pray, and if I could, I would work for this particular referendum to go before the voters and win the day and get this thing going. So I wish you a lot of luck, Manny, on this. And I can just tell you also that I just want to share one memory of 9/11 with you that really does stun me. And it was kind of a window onto the very warped values of this country. And maybe you can help me sort through this. And our listeners may recall that in the search for bodies in the debris of the World Trade Center in the days immediately following the attack, that I believe it was Rudolph Giuliani or federal officials stopped the search and actually told all the first responders and those searching the rubble for bodies to stand down while there was a search for gold in the basement of one of the World Trade Center buildings. And I thought that really spoke to a horrendous problem of priorities in this country, and particularly following that, you know, the dramatic and horrendous loss of life there. Is that something that sticks in your mind as well, Manny?
No, you know what? That's excellent that you brought that up. I think that actually is one of the 250 questions that were not answered. That when that story is repeated, and I'm very glad you've done this for your audience, because it just refreshed in my mind that memory. When that story is repeated, not only to family members, but to first responders whose brothers and sisters were in that pile, whose bodies needed to be taken out and properly respected, when that happened, I can't tell you how many firefighters and police officers are enraged at our local government at the time, and the individuals that were part of that decision to stop the recovery. That's outrageous. Why did that take place? Why does gold take precedence over recovering the bodies of heroes? This event begs for further investigation. This event that has caused chaos throughout the world. Tens of thousands of U.S. troops have been killed or maimed by wars of aggression since. Millions of Muslims, families, innocent Muslim families who are demonized by our media, have been murdered by our bombs because of this event. I'm a little tired of my uncle's name being used to fight what we're being told is a war on terror, where it really seems like a war of empire. I really feel that when we have an investigation that's proper and that's impartial and that answers questions, puts them on record, and protects those who are coming out and speaking out and risking their lives and their careers, I think once that gets to the public, we're going to be much better equipped, and we'll be empowered with a knowledge that will allow for us to protect ourselves so much more.
Manny, just a final question for you here, and we'll certainly repeat the websites that our listeners can go to get more information about your efforts and this referendum project. But what do you hope comes out of this commission? If some new answers are investigated and documented about what really happened in the days leading up to 9/11, that particular day of the attack and the aftermath, what would you want to see done with that investigation, the results of the investigation?
Well, I want the results of the investigation to show that we, the people, have the power in this country, that we're obligated by our Constitution to pursue the justice that's due our fallen. There will be closure for the family members. There will be answers for the first responders and their health concerns. There will be accountability for the American people and allowing them to know and assume the power that we really have. There will be lives saved in the future because we will be better equipped to understand how an event like this can take place, not by terrorists overseas, but terrorists here in this country, perhaps. You know, that's where the evidence is leading. There are so many different ways where a honest investigation will bring a better situation for the American people. And ultimately, I feel that when you have an investigation that's proper, you will be able to have the answers, and you will have the truth. And what that does is it allows for everyone to really become so much more empowered and to feel as if they're partaking in a democracy. They are, you know, partaking, critically thinking about events and making better decisions for our future. We as a country will be so much better off when we know exactly what happened on my uncle's murder, the unsolved crime of 9/11.
Well, Manny Badillo, thank you so much for being here, and what you're doing here I think is important work and successful, because it looks like you've collected the signatures. You have litigation, as you said, that you need to go through, but are you optimistic this will end up before the voters in November?
I am extremely optimistic, only because I know how much hard work has been put behind this and how much New Yorkers really want to have an investigation. It really comes down to what the city bureaucracy feels that we, the people, should have. It's unfortunate right now that, you know, even in this situation, that only one petition in the past quarter century has passed here in New York City, and that was term limits. And that was already overturned by city council to allow Bloomberg to run for a third term.
That's right. That's right. I remember that.
So I am still very optimistic, though I do know that even if it doesn't go through this year, it will go through and next year or the year after or whenever. There will be a proper investigation of the event. But I also feel that already this is a grand success. This petition is precedent-setting. And it is historical, and it is empowering, and it allows all municipalities, not just in this country but other countries, to pursue locally and to take part in democracy, to take those democratic actions, to pursue the justice and accountability that we all need. But ultimately, it empowers people to participate with each other. Communities and local communities are what really drives and changes our country. And I really hope that your listeners understand that with the events that took my uncle's life, that unsolved crime, for the truth to come out, we will be so better off.
Well, thank you, Manny. And leave our listeners, if you would, with the website of your group, the New York City Coalition for Accountability Now, NYC CAN. How do people find that?
People find that. You could just Google NYC CAN, or you can go to our website directly. That's www.nyccan.org. Take a browse through our site. Take a look and see what we've put together so far. We're constantly updating the site. And Scott, I really appreciate you having me on, and I really appreciate all your listeners for taking the time to listen to a vitally important issue.
And Manny, just before you go, is there a phone number you'd like to give out? Because we have listeners in the metro area here in Long Island, Connecticut, even, you know, Rhode Island, and spots around New York City who might want to lend a hand or ask more questions. Is there a phone number?
Well, there's a phone number that's on the website. I'll give you another one. That's 917-805-8080. Feel free to call. Just mention that you're in support of NYC CAN. If you have any questions, you know, we'd be more than happy to answer. Ultimately, I ask that people speak about this with their friends and their family and their coworkers and anyone. Write to your news stations, your local news stations, your local newspapers. Engage others with this information. Let others know that you heard about a family member that is putting together a petition for a new investigation, and then research on your own other family members, such as Bob McElveen, Donna Marshall O'Connor, Michelle Little. Look up some of the heroes of that day, like John Schroeder, Mike McCormick, Charlie Giles. Find out. These are names that we should know. These are names that are of people that are speaking out about the truth of what happened. And, Scott, again, I want to thank you.
All right, Manny. Have we talk again upon the certification of those signatures and the ballot going before the voters of New York City this November. So good luck with that, Manny. I hope we'll talk again.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much.
Good night. Take care. Bye-bye. That was Manny Badillo, a man who lost his uncle in the 9/11 attacks and an activist with the group New York City Coalition for Accountability Now, NYC CAN, their website, nyccan.org. We'll be back with a discussion of the effort to rein in nuclear weapons. Stay tuned. Of Michael Franti and Spearhead, I'm Not Alone. And this is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKN in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. And right now I'd like to welcome to the program Lorelei Kelly. She's director of the National Security Program at the American Progressive Caucus Policy Foundation, which she co-founded. She's also co-author of the Citizen's Handbook, Policy Matters, Educating Congress on Peace and Security. Lorelei, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I wanted to ask you about some hope that that you and maybe the world have about an upcoming United Nations conference, September 24th and 25th, on enforcement on the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which President Obama will chair. And maybe I can first ask you to comment on a speech that President Obama delivered on April 5th in Prague in the Czech Republic, where he declared that the United States had a moral responsibility to lead the effort to rid the world of nuclear arms because we had used them first. Tell us a bit about Obama and what he said in Prague.
Actually, the line that I loved the most about that Prague speech a couple months past was, Obama made a clear departure from our foreign policy, national security policy of the last 8 years in the prior administration when he said, our values make us stronger. And I think that that was really a missing piece and a loss of our strength and leadership to not understand over the past 8 years that the United States' greatest strength comes from the world perceiving us as playing by a uniform set of rules, as doing the same things that we tell others to do, of leading by moral authority rather than threats and coercion and use of force. And that doesn't mean I don't believe that we don't need a strong military. I do. I believe that. But I think that what he really pointed out was how we in this new century need to stand back, take a deep breath, and start off in a new direction, which actually builds on our strengths from our founding, this leading with our values out in front. And I think that that was the key line in that speech for me.
What do you think Obama brings different than his predecessors to this effort to rid the world of nuclear weapons, and if not that grand goal, which is certainly difficult to attain, at least substantially reducing the number of nuclear weapons around the world?
I think the fundamental thing that President Obama realizes, I actually think there are three key things that Obama is going to rebrand U.S. national security, to use sort of an expression from public relations, is that he understands that we can no longer, in today's world, we can no longer do anything on our own. We can't do what we want. We can't achieve our goals by ourselves. So cooperation is on our own self-interest, and we need to stand up and really live out the values that we are famous for, in fact, and all these collaborative institutions that we helped create, like the United Nations, is that we can no longer do anything alone, even if we want to. The second thing I think is really important is that Obama, I believe, is the first president of globalization, and he sees that it's the safety of people is what security is about. The safety of people within borders is important, but the safety of people across borders is as well, and this means non-Americans. You know, all these threats that we're facing are these threats that are widely distributed, from avian flu to the proliferation of dangerous nuclear materials. These are just two examples. That the safety of people within borders and across borders are equally important, and they're important at the same time. And that poses a huge challenge for policymakers who are used to these trade-offs, but that it's going to require a whole new set of policies and resources and personnel for us to get out there and take up these new challenges and really fundamentally do things differently. I actually think he's the first post-Cold War president in this way. And, you know, the Cold War ended in 1991.
Right, and I want to talk about those policies, because in Afghanistan, which we just talked about with Norman Solomon a few minutes ago, it's an issue where some people see President Obama sliding into a Vietnam-style escalation there. But before we go there, I wanted to talk more about the UN conference on the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. He is chairing that meeting, and what is likely to happen there? A lot of these things are pre-scripted, so what do we know?
Well, what I just saw an article, I think it just came out today, that has a lot of it has some hints at some very progressive overtures that the United States is going to make. And I think what they point toward collectively is what I just talked about, that the United States has got its game back, that we're going to get in there and be one of the problem solvers participating actively at the table, and we're going to welcome the inclusion of everybody who wants to play by these rules to make the world less dangerous, to reduce the risk of nuclear weapons and dangerous nuclear materials, and to really get into a problem-solving mode. And I think that Obama fundamentally understands that in today's world, power needs to be acknowledged rather than imposed, if that makes sense, that we require that other people are willing to listen to us and perceive us as a legitimate leader, and legitimacy means, like I said, leading by example, being perceived as doing what you tell others to do. I mean, I have a three-year-old, and I learn about legitimacy every single day when I make him eat out of a bowl, and I'm sitting there eating out of the cereal box with my hand. That's my example of the day. It doesn't make sense, and I think that what has happened over the last 8 years is the rest of the world has seen us sort of being judgmental and preaching a lot about these desires and goals, and then on the one hand, and then flouting them on the other, not participating. In fact, standing in the way of some real progress that makes all of us safer. And I think the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, you know, came about in the 60s, and it still hasn't been ratified in the United States. And we are the home of you know, we're the home of the deal makers. Americans are great deal makers, and instead of that, we've been perceived as sort of these flagrant rule breakers. You know, we've gone from deal maker to rule breaker in the last decade, and I really think that Obama wants to get that, you know, that status back, that people will take our example and be enthusiastic about it. It'll lead to so many other wonderful things for us in our safety and security if we have some success at these kinds of collective, collaborative venues like the UN's special session. And the fact that our president is leading it is wonderful. I mean, even if it's not as progressive, the outcome is not as progressive as some people, certainly some of my colleagues in politics on the left would like it to be, it's going to be a tremendous step forward. The fact that the United States is participating in a positive way is great.
Right. Well, the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, what's the importance of it? If it is signed into law in this country with ratification by the U.S. Senate, which we can talk about in a moment, what will be the positive result in your view?
I think the most positive result for all of us is that it'll really be a shot in the arm for what's called, it's an academic word, but an international regime of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And this is another one of those treaties from, you know, decades ago that has really stopped, not by power of force, but by power of persuasion, stopped a lot of countries from acquiring nuclear weapons. And this is a long, you know, it's basically a negotiation industry. It's all preventive. It sort of happens behind the scenes. The military is involved in it. I was teaching at the Air Force Academy a couple of years ago, and I met with a small group of students out there, Air Force students, who all wanted to be arms control negotiators. So this is something that is integrated in our government. The State Department has these negotiators, although it's something that we've really let atrophy and deplete over the last 20 years. So I think what it'll do is it'll refresh and reinvigorate this whole notion of step-by-step, pragmatic, negotiated solutions to big problems and reduce our risk in the process. You know, the more you have people dedicated to this kind of problem-solving, the more you have them out there talking to each other. And I'm not talking that this is all of a sudden going to make Iran come to the table in a cooperative way, or North Korea. But what I'm talking about is, in general, is if you can get everybody on this page of negotiating and cooperating and signing on the bottom line and playing by the rules, you can marginalize the ones who behave really badly. And then we have a lot more strength collectively to do something about it. You know, depending on what that is. Right now, it's sort of sanctions, or it's other kinds of ways to get them to shape up. I think far, far preferable to something like a military strike. And so the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, I think most of all, what it could do for us is get us back in the game as a legitimate, good faith player on the international stage. And at the same time, it's going to, I think, make us a lot safer, because it'll show the rest of the world that we believe in these cooperative efforts to reduce risk. And frankly, you know, since the end of the Cold War, we have to start going more in this direction. We can't do anything alone anymore. We can't keep ourselves safe on our own.
There There is the view put forward by some neoconservatives that the United States has to maintain its nuclear superiority at all costs. In fact, George W. Bush was pushing the design and construction of a new generation of battlefield nuclear weapons, as if he intended to use these things in future wars. And, of course, there was some workarounds by scientists that say, well, we don't have to test a new generation of nuclear warheads because we can do it on a computer, so we can sort of continue to build new nuclear weapons without actually exploding these things in violation of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. How do you respond to those ideas? And I may not have gotten them all articulated there accurately, Lorelei, but what's your response?
I think the first thing to say simply is that people who advocate that are really looking backward for inspiration. The truth is that in today's world, in a world of globalization and connectedness and information and rapid ability to, you know, to invoke lethal terror or participate at the table with everyone else, I think that this kind of idea that you can answer the question about power and superiority by using these obsolete, high-risk weapons of the last century really is missing the boat, because the truth is they increase our risk. If you look at the world as a place that has dramatically changed, which I do, I actually think, whether people like it or not, given the communications revolution, given the way that all nations and even individuals we saw on 9/11 have access to tremendous capacity to do damage and inflict harm, that we have to start doing things differently. And that looking backward for inspiration like that, I'm from New Mexico too, so I'm from a state that's dependent on the Cold War, on these nuclear weapons complexes. The sad part about that to me is you have a state like New Mexico that's full of brilliant PhDs, you know, physicists and these wonderful creative people. And they're still, you know, trying to make a better nuclear weapon? Are you kidding me? We would be safer if we just gave them their salaries for 5 years and asked them to do something to make the world a safer place. I know that sounds like a crazy hypothesis, but I wish that we could enact it, because I wager that we would be safer 5 years from now if we just let them and their creative genius create other ways to counterterrorism, to prevent the kind of immiseration that allows ideologies to become contagious and dangerous, to figure out sort of basic economic development structures, to figure out renewable energy, all of those things. That's what people need to think, is that our human resources and personnel who are dedicated to our security are then dragged into the past. And there's a limited hours in the day. Everybody understands that. We're looking backward for ways to keep us safe instead of looking forward and all the opportunities that exist to really actually get some achievements under our belt and moving forward and actually making the world safer. Besides which, these mini nukes, they completely violate the spirit of the Non-Proliferation Treaty that I was talking about. Like, why should other countries not try to pursue a nuclear weapon if the United States is telling everyone to join this treaty but is going ahead with its own research? It's that whole thing you learned when you were little. My mom used to say, you got to walk your talk.
Well,
these other people we're asking to cooperate with, they're not stupid. I mean, they see what we're doing. And you can't make these exceptions anymore.
Well said, and I hear the inspiration for what you do in the background there.
Oh, yeah, there's two little people. I'm trying to keep them satisfied with Clifford, and I think there's Shrek coming on next.
Okay. Lorelei Kelly is our guest, director of the National Security Program at the American Progressive Caucus Policy Foundation, which he helped co-found. And Lorelei, I want to ask you about this. What are the indications that President Obama is really, truly the country's first post-Cold War president? We had Presidents Clinton and Bush pursue NATO expansion after the demise of the Soviet Union. And, of course, President Bush, preceding Obama, had on the drawing board deployment of an anti-missile system in Eastern Europe, namely in Poland and the Czech Republic. There was a lot of fingerprints of the United States in confrontations that eventually arose in Russia's near abroad in Georgia. And, of course, there's a lot of perception in Russia itself that the United States was meddling in elections right around the Russian borders in states like the Ukraine. Are there indications that President Obama is really departing from these policies?
I actually think this is one of the things that we might be surprised with over the next week. I think we're going to really lessen the drive to put these the ballistic missile defense interceptors in Poland. I think that, you know, there's two different kinds of missile defense. One is sort of this theater, which has somewhat been proven to work. And then there's this sort of Star Wars fantasy of the 80s, which has been just over $100 billion at this point, which has never been proven to work. Even in sort of controlled laboratory conditions, it's lucky if these two things hit each other. So I think the other big, huge problem is that the countries that we're dealing with over there don't actually want them. I don't think the Czech Republic has approved of it yet. I think it's been a huge stink domestically. So there are lots of reasons not to move forward that way. And also, my sense is that 5 months ago it was a negotiating chip with Russia, and it's not as significant anymore. And I feel like it's one of those things that certainly conservatives like to, you know, beat everybody up with. But the truth is that we've moved on from that way of relating to other countries, and that, in fact, it makes them less safe because it's such a distraction from the real security threats that we all face, which I don't know if you all watch. You know, I just love the UK and their whole approach to terrorism. It's just, you know, police work. It's Scotland Yard. They just, you know, indicted these three men for making these plots to blow up airliners. And it was a couple years of, you know, typical surveillance and listening and human intelligence and talking to people. It's not high tech, and it's not going to save us in outer space. It's really the threats that we face today are really down to earth. It's not up to rocket scientists anymore. What we need to do is really figure out what skills just plain old, you know, human beings can bring to the table and work together, and how do we resource that? And how do we make it a priority? That's what I work on a lot with the U.S. Congress. And by the way, I'm actually on to something new. I'm not with the Progressive Caucus Policy Foundation anymore. I helped set that up and handed it off. I've set up a new initiative, this time with the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, which is another sort of a wonderful D.C. think tank that's worked on these issues for many years.
Well, Lorelei, I wanted to ask you about Iran. That seems to be certainly a very large problem confronting the White House and the world right now about where is Iran in terms of allegations that it's seeking to design and build a nuclear weapon. They deny that, saying, of course, that they are only trying to build their capacity to generate electric power with a nuclear power plant. What is it that the Obama administration can do to really end this very dangerous confrontation with Iran about their nuclear ambitions? And certainly ancillary to that is the implicit threat from Israel that if the United States doesn't act to prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon, that they may attack Iran's nuclear facilities with just as they did in Iraq many years ago.
Right, and by the way, attacking the facilities in Iraq has been proven to have not done one bit to make Israel more secure. But back to the larger strategic question of how Obama's interacting with the UN and the rest of the world is different and how it can make us safer with respect to Iran, I think it's actually a brilliant strategy for Obama to go to the UN and say, these are the rules of the road to keep us all safer, and we're back. We're going to be participating. We're going to be taking an active lead. We're going to play by these rules ourselves. And that makes Ahmadinejad look just marginalized and even more sort of a kook, besides this awful result of this election that happened over the summer, he looks like a thug, and he looks really out of it. He looks kind of like a crazy man, frankly. And I think that there's a lot of posturing going on right now, and countries say a lot of things in public while there's a lot of other stuff going on behind the scenes to actually create a negotiating framework. And it's my hope that this behind-the-scenes agreement to get back to the table and make some deals and get the Europeans back involved in a really, you know, strong way will result in something. I don't know what it's going to be, but will result in something that gets Iran back into a cooperative agreement that's transparent and accountable. But again, it's hard for the United States because the Nonproliferation Treaty, what people are talking about is an article that allows countries who are participants in the treaty who've signed up for it to develop peaceful uses of nuclear power, right? And that's the big loophole that, you know, one side is claiming, you know, the Iranians are saying this is our right, it's for nuclear power, and the whole public and the population there, by the way, really believes in that as well. So you're picking a fight with the whole population when you take on their right to have this, which is a real issue that we need to consider, especially given the election over the summer when we were, you know, the Twitter revolution, when we were really trying to be on the side of these young people who really wanted a democracy. And those kind of same collective legitimate rules apply here too. The United States needs to be a player and be seen as being an actual authority and a leader by leading by example. And by the way, you know, we just need to put forth these pragmatic steps that reduce the risk. I'm not somebody who stands up and says, you know, ban nuclear weapons forever, because I actually think that, you know, you can have your eyes on the prize, but we can't let that distract us from just taking the necessary steps to reduce the risk. When these neocons say that this is an important, you know, superiority and dominance, it's like trying to answer the question, how high is up? There is no answer to that question, how many? I mean, we have no idea what these weapons could do at this point. The weapons we have today could just completely alter life on Earth as we know it. They're far different than the ones that were used against Japan. I think it's completely irresponsible for people to say things like that instead of offering up problem-solving solutions that, by the way, don't cause the United States to all of a sudden be disarmed or weak or helpless. That's never going to happen. That is never going to happen.
Well, Lorelei, we've run out of time. Well, we should have you back again to talk more about these issues. We just kind of scratched the surface on a lot of these things, and we'd love to invite you back. But tell our listeners how they can get in touch with the groups you work with, including the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation.
Sure. I write for the Huffington Post, and I'm doing a lot of work on Afghanistan right now, so I'd love to talk to you about that sometime. And I think I'd give you some pretty different perspectives on why it's important to view Afghanistan completely different than the anti-war movement looked at Iraq, for example. But at the Huffington Post is the best. I mean, I try to post there once a week. You can go in there and look, and there's all my coordinates and information and a link to my new organization and all of that.
All right. Well, I appreciate you making time for us. And, again, we'd like to say a good hello to your inspirations there in the background watching Shrek or whatever
okay.
They're watching.
Perfect timing. I think the cartoons just wrapped up, too.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you being here tonight, Lorelei. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Good night.
Bye-bye. That was Lorelei Kelly. She was a former director of the National Security Program at the American Progressive Caucus Policy Foundation and currently with the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. That does it for our program Counterpoint tonight. Again, Eric Ford will be sitting here next Monday evening. I'll be back the last Monday in September. WPKN Radio in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM is what you're listening to. And my name is Scott Harris here Monday evenings, 8 to 10, and we'll be back again after Eric takes over next week. Go to our website, WPKN.org, for lots more information and program schedule changes that have just gone into effect a few weeks ago. And you can also go to the Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, where many of the interviews heard on Counterpoint tonight are also heard on that show in edited form. That's www.btlonline.org. You can subscribe to free weekly program summaries, interview transcripts, and podcasts. That's btlonline.org. Stay tuned, and we'll be back at you in just a few moments with Democracy Now! Stay with us.
Hi, this is Denise Manzari.
And this is Scott Harris, producers of Between the Lines Radio News Magazine.
Reminding you that you're tuned to WPKN Bridgeport at 89.5 FM.
And WPKN Montauk at 88.7 FM. And on the internet at WPKN.org.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!, the Toronto Declaration, no celebration of occupation. A protest at the Toronto International Film Festival takes center stage after a group of artists and writers sign a letter against the festival's decision to spotlight the city of Tel Aviv. Over 1,500 people have signed, including Jane Fonda, Viggo Mortensen, Danny Glover, and Harry Belafonte. We'll speak with journalist and author Naomi Klein, who helped draft the letter. We'll also talk to her about her Harper's Magazine cover story, Minority Death Watch, Jews, Blacks, and the, quote, post-racial presidency. Then a massive New York Times investigation finds chemical companies have violated the Clean Water Act more than 500,000 times in the last 5 years. An estimated 1 in 10 Americans has been exposed to drinking water that has dangerous chemicals or falls short of federal standards. Most of the violations have gone unpunished. We'll speak with a New York Times reporter who broke the story. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States and five partner countries have accepted Iran's new offer to hold talks, even though Iran insists it will not negotiate over its disputed nuclear program. The talks are expected to start in early October. If successful, this would be the first formal substantive talks between the United States and Iran since the Iranian Revolution 30 years ago. Iran last week handed over a package of proposals to the world powers, in which Tehran said it was willing to discuss global nuclear disarmament as well as other international issues in wide-ranging talks. But the document did not mention Iran's own nuclear program, which Iran maintains is only for civil energy uses. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs insisted that Iran's nuclear program will be discussed at the talks.
Certainly their willingness to talk about it is welcome. I'll tell you this. We're not talking for talking's sake. This may not have been a topic that they wanted to be brought up, but I can assure you it's a topic that that will bring up, and the P5 plus one will bring up. The Iranians have responsibilities to the international community to walk away from their illicit nuclear weapons program. That's what the focus from our side will be. These talks, and that's our goal.
A federal appeals court has rejected a lawsuit filed by four former Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib against the military contractor Khaki International. The men had accused the firm's employees of taking part in the torture and abuse of prisoners. In a 2-1 ruling, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit dismissed the case on the grounds that Khaki should be immune from prosecution because the company's employees were under U.S. military authority. The dissenting opinion was written by Judge Merrick Garland. He argued there's no judicial precedent that would prohibit the detainees from suing government contractors. Garland wrote, quote, "The plaintiffs in these cases allege they were beaten, electrocuted, raped, subjected to attacks by dogs, and otherwise abused by private contractors. At the current stage of the litigation, we must accept these allegations as true," unquote. The top commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan has admitted he sees no signs of a major al-Qaeda presence in Afghanistan. Speaking on the anniversary of the September 11th attacks, General Stanley McChrystal said, quote, "I do not see indications of a large al-Qaeda presence in Afghanistan now." But McChrystal says al-Qaeda still maintains close links to Afghan-based insurgents. He's expected to soon ask President Obama to send more troops to Afghanistan. More accusations have been aired about Afghanistan's recent presidential election. Afghan presidential candidate Abdullah Abdullah claims incumbent President Hamid Karzai used state resources to engineer the stealing of the August 20th presidential election. Abdullah says Karzai bribed tribal elders between $4,000 and $8,000 each to throw the election to Karzai. In other news from Afghanistan, the New York Times reports the Obama administration plans to issue new guidelines aimed at giving hundreds of prisoners in Afghanistan more ability to challenge their custody. However, the prisoners will not be given access to attorneys. Instead, the Pentagon plans to assign a U.S. military official to each prisoner. The official could help gather witnesses and evidence, including classified material on behalf of the detainees, to challenge their detention and proceedings before a military-appointed review board. Tens of thousands of right-wing activists gathered in Washington Saturday to condemn President Obama's plan to reform health care. Many protesters praised Republican Congressman Joe Wilson for calling the president a liar during his speech to Congress last night.
You lie!
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 Organizers had projected as many as 2 million protesters would attend, but the D.C. Fire Department put the final tally at approximately 60 to 70,000. Organizers included the Tea Party Patriots, ResistNet, and FreedomWorks. The Washington-based organization headed by former House Majority Leader Richard Armey of Texas. The march was also heavily publicized by Fox News host Glenn Beck. Meanwhile, in Minneapolis Saturday, 15,000 supporters of President Obama filled the Target Center to hear Obama speak.
If we do nothing, your premiums will continue to rise faster than your wages. If we do nothing, more businesses will close down. Fewer will be able to open in the first place. If we do nothing, we will eventually spend more on Medicare and Medicaid than every other government program combined. That's not an option for the United States of America. So, Minnesota, I may not be the first president to take up the cause of health care reform, but I am determined to be the last. We are going to get it done this year.
The State Department has revoked the visas of more than a dozen members of the coup government in Honduras, including the country's installed president, Roberto Micheletti, and 14 members of the Honduran Supreme Court. The move comes more than 2 months after a military coup ousted the democratically elected Manuel Zelaya. Here in this country, six groups have filed a federal lawsuit after being denied permits to protest during the G20 summit in Pittsburgh later this month. The suit was filed against the city, the Secret Service, and the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. Attorney Vitold Valchak of the Attorney of the American Civil Liberties Union said, quote, "What they're essentially doing is refusing permits for any demonstration in downtown."